I've entitled my message this morning, brethren, There Once Was a Man from Bethsaida. There once was a man from Bethsaida. An old saying goes, seeing is believing. Another one says, I once was blind, but now I see. But is it that easy? Well, the commonsensical notion is yes, it's actually that easy. You close your eyes, you see nothing. You open your eyes and you see whatever it is that's there. You see me talking at the lectern. You see the flowers, you see the table, unless you've got some big head in front of you. you're going to see me, and if you can't, I'd like you to just sit back and listen to a story that I'm going to tell you. It's a true story about a man named Sherrill. There once was a man named Sherrill. Sherrill was born in a pre-Civil War house in Virginia, and he was a seemingly normal child. Like any other at the time, he was a very clever little kid. He used to chase cows around the barnyard with a stick, have a lot of fun that way. And he was, I think it was about the age of three that I read that he was running around the barnyard with his family. But he, sure, he got into mischief like any other kids did at the time, any other boys at that age. We know that very well. But tragedy struck Sherrill's life. He developed spinal meningitis, cat scratch fever, and polio all at the same time when he was a young lad. And so the doctors, not knowing what to do with him, they sent him home to die. They didn't know how to treat him. They didn't know what to do. He went into a coma for a few weeks, and his mother did everything that she possibly could do to keep him alive. And eventually he did come out of that coma, and his mother had to retrain him to walk because he came out of a paraplegic. He had no use of his lower limbs, and it took her about 2 years of working with him incessantly to try and get him back up and walking again. And when he was ready for school, they found another problem. They found out that he couldn't see very well. Actually, Sherrill couldn't see well at all. They thought that maybe he hadn't been able to see since about the age of four. And so I believe, not knowing what took his sight at the time, the doctors diagnosed him with retinitis pigmentosa. And it's a hereditary condition that just sort of eats away at the retina and doesn't allow any light to transmit to the brain. And so at the beginning of his development, his sight was taken away from him. And as a result, Sherrill just didn't have any memories of sight as a child, just didn't have anything. And so he went to the school for the blind, and he didn't accept it at first, didn't want to be there. But then later deciding that if that was the way it had to be, then he was going to make the best of it. And so that's what Sherrill did. And he grew up like any other blind child in his day, learning to deal with the challenges of being blind. He learned to read Braille, and he constructed images in his mind about how he felt the world around him looked. And he used the other senses that became so keenly important to him, the sense of smell, the sense of touch, the sense of hearing, which were so important for blind individuals. And like most blind people do, Sherrill had, learn to develop these other senses to overcome the weaknesses, the lack of not being able to see. And it guided him through his daily activities. So he became a masseur. I mean, perfect job for someone who couldn't see. In his early 20s, he got that certificate, that degree, and he led a pretty happy and a pretty contented life. About the age of 50, though, Sherrill met someone. He met someone very important to him. Her name was Barbara, and she became his wife. And something was going to happen that was going to change Sherrill's life forever. Barbara had diabetes, and she had gotten regular eye exams at her ophthalmologist. And one day, she had made an appointment to go to her ophthalmologist to have her eyes checked, make sure everything was okay, because diabetes a lot of times strikes the eyes first in the retina. And so what she did was she brought Sherrill along with her, and she had an appointment for him as well. And so as Dr. Hamlin, the doctor who was seeing her, looked at Sherrill, and he listened to his story and his background intently, he began to think that Sherrill maybe didn't have retinitis pigmentosa after all. Because what he found out was that Sherrill could actually see some shades of light. He could actually see the shadow of a hand that would pass before his eyes. So he thought, well, the retina must still be intact. But Sherrill had these thick cataracts on his lenses, And Dr. Hamlin couldn't see past him to look at the retina to see if it was clear or not. And so he began to surmise that maybe his blindness was really due to his cataracts and not to his retina. Well, cataract surgery was pretty routine and common at this time. This was 1991. And they were thick, but they thought, well, what's the risk? I mean, it's very little downside, and the reward is probably pretty great. So they went ahead and decided to go ahead and do surgery. There was, like I say, little to lose, and I thought a lot to gain. So they removed one cataract and then the other in both eyes. And then Cheryl opened his eyes. And what is it, do you think, that Cheryl saw when he opened his eyes? I'd like you to turn to Acts chapter 9. Turn over to Acts chapter 9 with me. I'll let you think about that for a moment. Acts chapter 9. Saul, who was going to become the Apostle Paul, was on the road to Damascus here in this section. And he was coming from Jerusalem with a letter that was given to him by the high priest to go to Damascus and give him to the authorities there, the synagogue, so that they would begin to cooperate with Paul, or Saul, on taking the Christians back to Jerusalem. And so it was along this road that he was struck blind. And in Acts chapter 9 and verse 4, let's see what happened to Saul as he was struck blind. And as he fell to the earth, he heard a voice saying to him, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" In verse 7, the men which journeyed with him stood speechless, hearing a voice, but seeing no man. And Saul arose from the earth, and when his eyes were open, he saw no man. And they led him by the hand and brought him to Damascus. And he was 3 days without sight, and neither did he eat or drink. And so Saul, we read, we go on, and it says that he went to the house of Judas to wait for a man that God was going to send to anoint him, named Ananias, and he was going to lay hands on him. And in verse 17, we drop down, it says, Ananias went and entered into the house, and he put his hands on him, and he said, "Brother Saul, the Lord Jesus, who appeared to you in the way in which you came, has sent me to you that you might receive your sight and be filled with the Holy Spirit." And immediately there fell from his eyes, as it had been, scales. And he received sight forthwith. He received his sight immediately. And he arose and he was baptized. And so Saul continued his life after this episode, with sight, just as he had before. Now turn over with me to Mark chapter 10. Mark chapter 10, and I want to read another account of an individual who was blind. Mark chapter 10, and we'll read it here in verse 46, Mark chapter 10, and this other incident here. And it says, "And they came to Jericho, and he was with his disciples, and a large crowd went out from Jericho, blind Bartimaeus." Bar is just the son of, so this is the son of Timaeus, was sitting by the side of the highway begging. And verse 50, "And casting away his garment, he rose up and came to Jesus," because Jesus called him. "And answering Jesus, he said to him," Jesus said to him, "What do you desire that I should do to you?" And the blind man said to him, "My Lord, that I may see again." And Jesus said to him, "Your faith has healed you." And instantly he saw again, and Jesus, and followed Jesus in the way. "I once was blind, but now I see." The brilliant neurologist Oliver Sacks, that later came to examine Cheryl, had asked the question to himself before. He had thought about this. He thought to himself, what would restored sight be like in a patient who had lost his sight before, who had been blind? Would it be normal from the moment that his sight was restored to him, the moment he could see again? Well, looking at the account of these last two passages here that we just read, I think we could reasonably assume that the eyes of the blind will be open, the scales will fall from their eyes, and they will see. They will look out and they will see everything around them in creation and whoever's in front of them. And on his happy way, he will go and he will tell everyone what happened to him regaining his sight. Well, back at the office, as Cheryl sat there, he was excited after a lifetime of blindness that his first vision was going to be his bride-to-be that was sitting in front of him. And as they were getting ready to pull those patches off of his eyes, What was it that Sherrill saw when he opened his eyes? What did he see? This is what he saw. He saw light. He saw shades. He saw movement. He saw color. But it was all mixed up. It was just a jumbled mess. It was meaningless. It was simply a blur. That's what he saw. And then out of this blur came this voice that said, "Well?" And it wasn't until then that Sherrill had finally realized that this chaos of light and shadow and movement in front of him, this blur in front of him, was actually a face. It was Barbara. In other words, Sherrill didn't recognize a face when he saw one until he heard something that came out of it, until his brain connected what he was seeing to an understanding that voices come out of faces. He didn't understand that. And you might be thinking, well, you know, this is kind of like waking up from a sleep and you kind of groggy and you kind of film over your eyes and you can't see very well. And as time passes, you'll be able to see a little bit better. And you know how people come around and they put their hands on your eyeballs and they press them in. And when you open up, everything's kind of blurry. And eventually, after a couple of minutes, you can see better. Well, it wasn't like this. It wasn't like this at all. Sherrill, his retinas were intact. I actually found that out. His retinas were very intact. His optic nerve was intact. He was transmitting information to his brain. Even his primary visual cortex was intact. So where did the problem lie? Well, the problem was this, that Sherrill was seeing like a 3 to 6 month old baby saw. That's what a baby sees early in life. They just see blurs and colors and, well, actually they don't see colors, but they see just shadows. And that's what he was seeing. You see, since he went blind at such an early age and he'd been blind for so long, Sherrill's primary visual cortex hadn't developed to the fullest extent that we have in our brains. But most importantly, and I think this is the most important part, that his primary visual cortex didn't develop connections with what's called secondary association centers. There's other areas of the brain that connect to the primary visual cortex to help you understand certain things. In other words, there's ways that the corpus callosum connects between the right and the left half. So if I say to Tom, "Hey, let's take it outside," the left brain says, "Oh, okay, he's going to tell me something." The right brain has got to discern the information, what the way my face is saying this. "Oh, does he want to go outside to fight?" You know, there are other areas that have to come into play to be able to discern what information you're receiving. So the information was getting there, but he hadn't developed this perception to know what he was seeing, and it's a condition called visual agnosia. Visual agnosia, and you're probably familiar with this term, but you know, agnosia is like agnosticism. It's like you don't know what you don't know whether, you just don't know. And this is what this problem was. He could see, but he just didn't know what he was seeing. So everyone in this office, as he, you know, had these bandages taken off of his eyes, imagine something that was so much more simple. A man opens his eyes, the light falls on the retina, it hits the cortex, and then voila, you see, and you can see everybody out here, you see the trees and the grass and everything else. But they began to find out that adapting to a visual environment was very hard for Sherrill. It was very, very challenging. In fact, once very simple tasks for him while he was blind became nearly impossible tasks for him when he gained his sight. This man who had for decades walked all about town with the use of a cane, and had traveled without difficulty on public transportation, now said that he found walking scary. He said it was confusing, and without touch, without his cane, steps in particular now posed a special hazard because all he could see was this confusion. All he could see was a flat surface of crisscrossing lines. He couldn't see dimensions. He couldn't tell if a skyscraper was going up. It was just lines to him. Solid objects, as I said, he couldn't tell if they were going up or down. His wife said that he would look at the ground and he would just groan. Ugh. He has to walk. I have to walk. You know, he would freak out because he didn't know what to do. He didn't know how to handle it. And he almost had to close his eyes to be able to walk again. You see, the brain has hardwired within itself the ability to see colors, to see movement. We can see those things, but we have to learn how to put those things together to make sense of them. And Cheryl didn't have those pathways developed in order to put them all together. So here we have this 50-year-old man who was seeing like a baby. He'd look at a table, you know, he'd see a table in his living room and he'd say, well, what's that? And his wife would say, well, it's a table. And he would say, oh, well, let me see. And he would go to feel it. And that's the way he would understand that it was a table. His first month was a systematic exploration of sight and touch and of all the smaller things in his house. And he would grab fruit and vegetables and bottles and little knickknacks and cans and cutlery and everything that he could grab. And he'd pick it up and he'd turn it around and he'd hold it and he'd look at it. And, you know, he'd hold it up close and he'd hold it far away. And he would move in every dimension to try and figure out what it was so that he could understand what he had never seen before. And another important point is that he had to come to some sense of unitary objecthood, which means he had to put parts together to be able to see it as a whole. And he never could do that because he'd never seen before. You know, I remember several years ago being in a video store actually up here in town, and I remember being there with my wife before we had kids, and there was a girl and a boy there, and the girl was 7 or 8, and the little boy was maybe 4 years old or something. And they were checking out from the video store, checking out. And the video store has this brilliant idea of putting the candy right there. You know, you're checking out, and the candy's right here as you're checking out, right? So you're kind of standing back from the candy, and you're reaching over. And, of course, the four-year-old boy is right here in front of the candy, right face level. They know what they're doing. So, I said to my wife, look at this little boy here. And so he grabs the first candy bar. You know, they've got all candy bars, Crackle and you know, I can't even think of Snickers, and everything else is all lined up there in a row. And so he picks this candy bar up, and he holds it in front of his mother, and he goes, Mommy, I want this one. And she says, No. She's trying to pay, and she's not paying attention. No, put it back. And so he puts it back, and he grabs the second one. Mommy, I want this one. And no, put it back. And so what do you think he did? They grabbed the third one in line. He picked it up and he turned it around. And he looked at it. Mommy, I want this one. I just love this one I want. And you know, that little boy went through every single one. Every single one, all the way till the end. And his mom, you know, took it out of his hand and she said, put it back. And he did that right down the line. And, you know, I'm sure he thought to himself, anything that comes in a flashy little wrapper has to be good. And so he was drawn into that. But I thought about this later. And I remember saying at the time to my wife, I said, when we have kids, we're never going to do that. But that didn't work. But I thought about this later, and I thought, you know, this is the way kids are. I mean, kids, this is new. This is developing for them. They pick up this candy bar wrapper. They see this. They're crinkling it, they're turning around, they're looking at this in every way, shape, and form to try and figure out what this thing is and what it means to them. And they're developing these secondary association centers in their brains. They're coming to some sort of understanding of what this is. You and I don't have to pick up candy bars and wrappers to be able to tell what they are. We can look at it, and we already have a sense in our mind of what it feels like, what it tastes like, what it looks like. It's all there. Kids don't have that. So our secondary association centers are developed in that way. Now, if I put you in a showroom of new cars or new boats, some of you gentlemen, you're going to feel the leather. You're going to run your hand down it. You're going to walk along. You're going to look at the lines. It's something new. It's something different to you. You can't hardly stop from touching it. Put some of you ladies in some stores with clothing or, you know, some home decorating and stuff like that, and you're going to touch it. You're going to feel it. When you see any new thing that comes along in Walmart, you've got to put your hand on it. You've got to touch it. You've got to feel it. If you've seen it before, it's not a big deal. You can pass right by. There's no temptation there to do that. So we're developing those centers as we go along even today, but children even more so than we are even now. So here we have this development of these pathways. And we have this 45-year head start on Cheryl. You know, there's this quote from a French painter, from Paul Cézanne, and he once wrote this. He said, the same subject seen from a different angle, gives a subject for study of the highest interest and so varied that I think I could be occupied for months without changing my place simply by bending more to the right or bending more to the left. And that's the way we are with things. You see them from different angles and your mind begins to take these and make a complete unit with them. Cheryl's neurologist said that Cheryl would pick up details incessantly. He would pick up an angle, an edge, a color of movement, but he wasn't able to synthesize them to form a complex perception at a glance. He couldn't tell the difference between a cat or a dog unless he touched it. And it was that way with many other things. Now, I hope I've captured your attention thus far with this story. And if I haven't, I want you to really pay attention to this point because this brings it home. Because this is very fascinating. He couldn't put a cat together. It was very puzzling to him. He could see cats in its parts. He could see a paw. He could see a tail, or an ear, a nose. But he couldn't put the cat together as an entire unit. He couldn't see it as a unit. And this is the way he saw human faces, too. He could see an eye, a mouth, a nose, but he couldn't put the whole thing together. He usually only recognized animals going to the zoo by a single feature, whether the kangaroo hopped or whether the zebra had stripes or whether, the leopard had spots. That's the way he understood an animal, the lions because of their roar. Well, a few days after the operation, Cheryl said this. He said, "Trees don't look like anything on earth." He said, but 1 month later, Cheryl finally began to put a tree together. His wife said, "He now knows that the trunk and the leaves go together to form a complete unit." I'd like you to turn to Mark chapter 8. Mark chapter 8, if you would. Mark chapter 8 starts off with the story of Christ feeding the 4,000 with 7 loaves. And I'm sure you're all familiar with this story. And after they were done eating, the disciples took 7 lunch baskets of fragments. And we see quite a miracle here. We're not going to go through this section, but this is what happened before. And we get to chapter 8, verse 10, and it says, "And immediately he entered into a boat with his disciples and came to the region of Dalmanutha. And the Pharisees came to him and began to dispute with him, seeking a sign from heaven from him, tempting him. And he sighed deeply in his spirit. And he said, 'Why does this generation seek a sign? Truly I say to you, there shall no sign be given this generation.'" Now I'll read from Matthew 16, you don't have to turn over there, but the companion says, "And in the morning it will be foul weather, for the sky is red and lowering. O you hypocrites, you can discern the face of the sky, but you cannot discern the signs of the times. A wicked and adulterous generation seeks after a sign. There shall be no sign given it, but sign of Jonah the prophet." And then he left and departed. Now we see that the Pharisees wanted a sign from Jesus. They were tempting him. They wanted something. Christ said, listen, he said, if you're going to be able to look at the sky and you're going to be able to tell if rain is coming or not, why is it that you can see the signs of the sky but you can't tell what's going on today? Why do you need a special sign for today? He said, how blind are you? How blind are you that you cannot perceive what is going on? So, back to Mark chapter 8, verse 13, we're going to continue on because I think that's important with what Christ is telling us here. "And he left them and he entered into the boat again and he departed to the other side, and the disciples had forgotten to take loaves, and they did not have more than 1 loaf in the boat with them. And he charged them, saying, 'Take heed, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod.' And they reasoned among themselves, saying, 'Is it because we have no loaves?' And knowing it, Jesus said to them, 'Why do you reason it's because you have no loaves? Do you yet perceive and not understand, or nor understand? Have you still hardened your hearts? Do you have eyes and do not see? Do you have ears and do not hear? Do you not remember? When I broke the 5 loaves among 5,000, how many handbaskets of fragments did you take up?' And they said to him, 12. And when the 7,000, when there were 7 among 4,000, how many lunch baskets full of fragments did you take up?" And they said 7. And he said to them, "Well, how do you not understand? How do you not understand this?" You see, it wasn't about this lonely loaf of bread that they were trying to figure out, this bread that they had forgotten. Christ said he could make more if he needed to. He could make a whole lot more, frankly. But he wanted them to understand what he was talking about. He wanted them to see what he was talking about. And this is where understanding comes in. There once was a man from Bethsaida. We read in Matthew 16 that it says that they understood that he then was not talking about the loaves, but about being aware, bewaring of the leaven of the bread of the doctrine of the Pharisees and Sadducees. This came to light to them. And in verse 22, he came to Bethsaida, and they brought a blind man to him and begged him to touch him. And he took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the town. And when he had spit on his eyes, he had put his hands on him, and he asked him if he saw anything. And he looked up and he said, "Well, I see men walking as trees." And after that, he put his hands again on him, on his eyes, and he made him look up the second time. And he was restored, and he saw everything clearly. Please look closely here. Jesus had asked him if he could see anything. And he said, "Yes, I see people who look like walking trees. That's what I see." I think that's very curious, isn't it? Very curious here. Remember I said that the two things that are inherent with the functioning of the brain are motion and color? Motion and color. Well, he saw movement. He saw trees walking. That's what he saw. But notice that he wasn't able to put the pieces together to form the complete picture as it should be. He could see, but he couldn't understand what he was seeing. And that's what we found out here. See, like Cheryl, this man really didn't have a good depth perception either, I don't think. I mean, men looked like trees. I'm not sure what kind of trees they had back there at the time. I'm not too privy on that. But, the foliage on a tree is rather leafy. Maybe he had seen some afros in his time. I don't know. Maybe he was thinking about that. Not too many trees are as short as a man either. But you see, this story of the Bethsaida blind man is not just a poetic account alone, as some have thought in the past. No, it's actually a clinical description. Because like Cheryl, this blind man from Bethsaida could now see something, but he had this additional complication of visual agnosia. He couldn't understand what he was seeing. He couldn't make sense of what he was seeing. And frankly, how could Mark know this when he had written this down at the time? It's impossible that he would know something like this. This condition didn't have a name back at that time. Well, how could seeing be so hard? How could it be so difficult? Oliver Sacks, the neurologist, explains it this way. He says this. He wrote in the New Yorker magazine an article entitled "To See and Not See." He said, "The rest of us sighted can scarcely imagine such confusion. For we, born with a full complement of senses and correlating these one with another, create a sight world from the start as a world of visual objects and concepts and meanings. And when we open our eyes each morning, it's upon a world we have spent a lifetime learning to see. We're not given the world, we make our world through incessant experience, categorization, memory, reconnection." But when Cheryl opened his eye, after being blind for 45 years, having little more than an infant's visual experience, and this, long forgotten, there were no visual memories to support a perception. There was no world of experience and meaning awaiting him. He saw, but what he saw had no coherence. His retina and his optic nerve were active, transmitting impulses, but his brain could make no sense of them. And I believe that this blind man from Bethsaida was not born blind. He was most likely lost his sight somewhere at a young age, maybe like Cheryl did, maybe early childhood, because he seemed to know what trees were when he saw it. He seemed to know what men looked like when his sight was restored, but he couldn't put the pieces of the puzzle together to tell the two apart. And so then when Jesus had laid his hands on him again and he healed his agnosia so that he could see everything clearly after that. And you see, the restoration of sight, brethren, is a two-step process. The gift of sight is the first step, but the all-important second step is understanding what we're seeing. And that's what Jesus imparted to the blind man the second time he laid his hands on him. And in one miraculous instant, his brain was taught what the rest of us have learned from childhood to now. And in one miraculous instant, his mind was capable of understanding his world, where Cheryl today, even today, has never come to that place. And with one miraculous instance, Jesus has taught us that he is the great healer and that he truly has come to restore the sight to the blind, as the prophet Isaiah had written so many years ago. Well, what is it that we can learn from this account of Cheryl and from this blind man from Bethsaida? Well, I have 3 points for you that we can learn from these stories. 3 points. The first one is this. Number one is hardened hearts block understanding. Hardened hearts block understanding. You remember how the disciples had reasoned among themselves with Christ, and they'd said to them, when Christ had said to them, "Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of the Sadducees," and they thought, "Well, it must be because we brought only one loaf with us on the boat." Well, it was because their hearts were hardened. Look at Mark chapter 8 again. Mark chapter 8 and verse 17. We'll read this again. They didn't understand. They didn't understand. Mark chapter 8, 17, it says, "And knowing it, Jesus said to them, 'Why do you reason that it is because you have no loaves? Do you not yet perceive nor understand? Have you still hardened your heart? Do you have eyes and do not see? Do you have ears and do not hear and do not remember?'" You know, I think this is fascinating because in medical circles, there's a term that's used very commonly. It's called plasticity. And I know that many of you are familiar with this term. But plastic is a term from the Greek that means to mold. And in human physiology and anatomy, plasticity, as it refers to the nervous system, is a very, very good thing. It's very good. The more plastic an individual is, the easier it is for an individual to learn, the quicker a person can learn, and the easier it is for someone to change. And I think that one of the things that when Christ was talking about, becoming his little children, I think he was talking about this becoming plastic. Children are very tend to be very teachable. They learn rather quickly. They're very humble and adaptive. And good plasticity really allows for this to occur. Children's brains, in fact, are very, very plastic. They learn at such rapid clips and rapid paces. It's amazing. And the older we get, the less plastic the brain becomes. It just becomes more rigid, more hard. It just doesn't change rather quickly. It's harder to learn to play a piano at age 50 than it is at age 10. But learning to play a piano at age 50 is very good for your brain because it forces those neurons to fire more than they normally would. So the harder it is to change these connections in the brain, we know that it produces different outcomes. So let me give you an example. My wife, for instance, has a sister, Karen too, have a sister who lives in Canada, and they have a little girl and a little boy. The mother speaks, when they were young, the mother spoke English to them. The father's French-Canadian. He spoke French to them. And they learned both languages. And it was a very passive sense. I mean, it was just there. They talked to them in both languages, and they learned quickly. They learned rather quickly. It's very challenging for us as we get older to learn different languages. Some of you may have taken Spanish even in high school or younger. And most of the people I talk to that maybe took 3 or 4 years of Spanish in school and haven't used it don't remember it. They don't remember much of it, maybe a little bit. But if you learn it as a younger child, like these kids right here, they'll never forget that. Those things that you learn way back when, those are the things that you tend not to forget. I remember thinking about this when I was putting it together, thinking about some of the older things that I remember. Even as you get older, a lot of your older members, they remember a lot of the stories from when they're young, but they don't remember the older ones as they get older. I still remember my PT number, my plain truth number. I mean, can rattle that right off the top of my head, but I have a problem sometimes remembering the combination of my safe. It's not a good thing. but that leads, that lends to what I'm talking about, this plasticity. So when Cheryl, at the age of 50, had regained his sight, he had a very difficult time. Because, number one, there were no stored memories, there was no stored images in his brain to make sense of what he was seeing when he could see. And secondly, his brain was much less plastic at the age of 50 than it was at the age of 5 or at the age of 10 or whatever. And this is one of the reasons that he has had such a difficult time learning and has what is today called psychotic blindness. He has that even to this day. That's right, Cheryl cannot see to this day because of psychotic blindness. He never adapted well, and he regressed back into a blind state. And there have actually been other people who have regained sight in some of the similar cases to Cheryl and have never been able to restore their sight. But the blind man from Bethsaida, I think, that must have had some images stored in his brain from a previous visual experience. But God overcame the hardness of his neurons, or this lack of plasticity to completely heal him. And in spiritual terms, brethren, in spiritual terms, our hardened hearts have to be softened and made plastic so that we can change, and so that we can grow, so that we can understand. You'll remember the story back when the Israelites were to be let go of Egypt and Pharaoh hardened his heart and he would not let the children of Israel go. And Pharaoh had this unchangeable heart because it was a hardened heart. And the disciples had this hardened heart too that had to be changed. They had to be softened so that they could perceive, so that they could understand what Jesus was telling them. So when Christ reminded them about feeding the 4,000 with 7 loaves, it says in Matthew 16, which we read, that they finally understood what Jesus was telling them. So I think the question that we have to ask ourselves out of this is, how is our heart doing? How is our heart doing? It's important for us to take a look inside of ourselves, look in the mirror of the Bible, look in the mirror of Jesus Christ, and to say, are we hardened to the point that we cannot understand, that we cannot learn, that we cannot see the things that are right in front of our eyes? Are we unable to see the flaws in our character? Are we unable to make those changes to become more Christ-like? God is so desperately trying to show us things in our life that need to be changed. He's so desperately trying to get us to move to a position that is closer to that of Jesus Christ. And so when we have those opportunities, it's important that we take them, and we ask Christ that he will change us and make us more plastic so we can learn, we can grow, and then that law of God can be written on not a table of stone, not a hardened heart, but a soft and a fleshy and a plastic heart. Point number two that we can learn out of these stories is this. Point number two is, we're given understanding when it's right for us. We're given understanding when it's right for us. The disciples came to Christ and they asked him why he spoke in parables. Matthew chapter 13, and for sake of time, if you would, I'm not going to have you turn there, but Matthew chapter 13, I'll read it. Therefore speak I to them in parables, because they see not see, and hearing they hear not, neither do they understand. And in them is fulfilled the prophecy of Isaiah, which says, by hearing you shall hear and shall not understand, and by seeing you shall see and not perceive. In Mark chapter 4, it says that they that seeing they may see and not perceive, and hearing they may hear and not understand, lest at any time they should become converted and their sin should be forgiven them. So he spoke in parables, so not that they could understand, but so that they couldn't understand. And I believe that God orchestrates events in people's lives so that when conversion comes to them, that it's at the right time for them. It's at the right place. It's at the right time so that they're ready for it. It's not at a time, in other words, when something disastrous is going to happen that will take them away. In a newly sighted individual, learning to see demands a radical change in neurological functioning, and with it, a radical change in psychological functioning. In other words, in self, in identity, in understanding, even who they are. Cheryl had to come to that, or try to come to that. And how true that is with conversion, is to look at ourselves and to come to a new sense of identity. The change has been expressed in terms of life and death, as it is with conversion. Valvo had quoted a patient as saying this. He said, the patient said, one must die as a sighted person to be born again as a blind person because it's so difficult to adapt. Valvo goes on to say, and the opposite is equally true. One must die as a blind person to be born again as a seeing person. Because Cheryl and the others have shown us that it's so hard to be blind, and actually it's harder to be blind, and then to have the sight restored than it is to go the other direction. So much harder than to have sight and lose it. There have been a handful of other people over the past 300 years that have gained sight. In fact, I've found six. I found in the literature six people who have gained their sight back. But Cheryl's blindness was by far the longest out of any of them, 45 years. 45 years he was blind. Gregory, who was a doctor, had another patient who was well adapted to blindness before his operation. And at first, this patient was delighted with seeing, and he was older than Cheryl there was less time where he was blind than Cheryl when he regained his sight. So he adapted a little bit quicker, a little bit more easily. But he said this, but soon after he had encountered intolerable stresses and difficulties, he found the gift, and it would be a gift, but for these men, it wasn't particularly a gift. But he found the gift transformed into a curse and became deeply depressed, and soon after he died. And you know that almost all of the earlier patients encountered the exact same problem. Exactly the same problem. And after their initial euphoria, they were overwhelmed by the enormous difficulties of adapting to this new sense that had been given to them. And just like most of the others, Cheryl had become very sick as well. And one neurologist explained it this way. He said this. He said, if stimulation occurs beyond a critical point, a point at which the perceptual cognitive processes can link the real world to their perceptual world, then the perceptual self may collapse with the collapse of perceptual systems, altering the orientation and the very identity of the individual. If this occurs, an individual not only becomes blind, but ceases to behave as a visual being. And because of this, Cheryl was given to outbursts of rage, rage at his helplessness and sickness, raging at the smashing of a promise and of a dream that was coming his way. And beneath this, most fundamental of all, a rage that had been smoldering in him almost from the beginning, rage at being thrust into a battle that he could neither renounce nor he could win. At the beginning, there was certainly amazement, wonder, and sometimes joy, and it was an adventure, an excursion into a new world, the like of which few have ever entered. But then came the problems, the conflicts of seeing, but not really seeing, not being able to make sense of a visual world, at the same time being forced to give up his own. He found himself between two worlds, at home in neither, a torment from which no escape seemed possible, until a second blindness came upon him, and he left the world of light and vision, and he went back to his former world of darkness. Thank God, brethren, that when he calls us and he draws us to himself, that it's in his time, it's in his way, and it's in his wisdom. We're given a choice when we're converted, and when that light falls upon our eyes, our minds are open and we can see. But when someone chooses to go back to their vomit as a dog would, to go back to their wallowing in the mire as a sow would, to remove their hand from that plow, all they have is this waiting for the judgment and a fearful looking, a fiery indignation. We're given understanding. God gives understanding what's the right time. The right time. One more point on this particular second point, is that Jesus Christ doesn't leave us hanging in our conversion process either. He didn't just give the man from Bethsaida sight and give him the ability to understand. No, he didn't leave him, brother, between these two worlds. He didn't leave him there at home in neither, this transition that Cheryl had found himself in. No, he helps us make the transition so that when we understand, we make sense of what we see, and he helps us through it. Point number three is our understanding of the things of God is progressive. I don't really like the term progressive for what it stands for today, but I have to use that for what I'm saying here. Our understanding of things of God is progressive. I'd like you to turn to John chapter 9, if you would. John chapter 9. I'd like to illustrate this point with another story, with the story of another blind man. To get the context here, we just came out of the last great day. Of course, in John 7, it gives us the context. This was, Jesus said that Jesus stood and he cried aloud, "If any man thirst, let him come unto him and drink." And then in verse 2 of chapter 8, it says, and it was the next day. So to set the context, this was on the last great day that this particular story took place, because it says he came in the morning and he came again to the temple. And he began to teach people. And in chapter 9 of John, in verse 1, it says, "And as Jesus passed by, he saw a man which was blind from his birth." Now already we see something different in this story. We see that this blind man is different from the blind man from Bethsaida. Because this man was born blind, while the man from Bethsaida, I don't believe, was. This was the last great day, as I mentioned, and I don't think it's a coincidence that this story takes place on the last great day. In verse 2, "And his disciples asked him, saying, Master, who did sin, this man or his parents, and he that he was born blind? And Jesus answered, Neither has this man sinned nor his parents, but that the works of God should be made manifest in him. I must work the works of him that sent me while it is day. The night comes when no man can work. As long as I'm in the world, I am the light of the world." So he's declaring here to what he declared to the Pharisees earlier in chapter 8, that he was the one who gives light and illuminates the world. Mr. Robinson gave the fine message on the last great day, and he talked about the giant menorahs, I believe, illuminating Jerusalem. Christ says, "I am the one that will illuminate you, illuminate the minds of men." Verse 6, "When he had spoken, he spit on the ground, and he made clay of the spittle, and he anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay. And he said to him, Go wash in the pool of Siloam," which is by interpretation sent. "And he went his way therefore and washed and came seeing." Now I want you to notice three things briefly here with this story. Three things. Number one, we see that there was no profession of faith by this man, and there was no condition of it laid upon him by Jesus. Jesus simply anoints the eyes of the man to heal him. The blind man here was put for the express purpose of showing the works of God in him. Second thing we notice here is that he was washed. He washed once and immediately began to see. Unlike the man from Bethsaida, who didn't immediately begin, but in another sense, it is kind of like the blind man from Bethsaida. And number three is this. When he came seeing, as it says here in verse 7, at this point in the story, he says nothing. He doesn't say anything. He returns in silence. Now let's go ahead and look at verse 8. Go on. Verse 8, The neighbors therefore, and they which before him had seen him, said that he was blind, "Is not this he that sat and begged?" And some said, "This is he," and others said, "He is like him." But he said, "I am he." And so finally, here we have something that this blind man has said. So we have something that he has said to us, and he insists that he is that man who was the beggar that they were arguing over. He had been the blind beggar all of his life. In verse 10, "Therefore said they unto him, Well, how were your eyes opened?" And in verse 11, "He answered and he said to them, A man that is called Jesus made clay and anointed my eyes, and said to me, Go to the pool of Siloam and wash. And I went and washed, and I received sight." And so when they asked him how he received his sight, he really doesn't tell any more than what the narrative has already told us. He really doesn't tell us anything new. Calls Jesus a man. Maybe that's something different. That's the way he sees him. And at this point, really, he doesn't appear any closer to Jesus than he did at the beginning of the story. Now look at verse 12. "Then he said to them, Well, where is he? And he said," the blind man said, "Well, I don't know. I don't know where he's at." So now he's moved from this position of silence to a confession of ignorance. He says, I know not. In verse 13, they brought to the Pharisees him that aforetime was blind, and it was the Sabbath day, the last great day, when Jesus had made the clay and he opened his eyes. And then again, the Pharisees also asked him how he had received his sight. Now, I want you to notice how he answers them. He actually says less than what he told the others. He said to them, he put clay upon my eyes and I washed and I do see. Well, then what happened was the Pharisees fell into this arguing amongst themselves about Jesus, and he turned to the man, and they turned to the man again in verse 17, drop down to verse 17, and they said to the blind man again, what say you of him that he has opened your eyes? And he said, notice what he says, he is a prophet. He says he is a prophet. So the first time in this story, this man who was formerly blind now says something new. He says something original. He says something that comes out of a growing understanding. He is a prophet. He's come from silence to a confession of ignorance to a claim now that Jesus is a man from God. And the Pharisees, they still didn't believe him. They asked his parents, and his parents said, well, he's a grown boy. Why don't you go talk to him? And so they went back to the man again in verse 24. So it's quite an ordeal here. Verse 24, and then again they called to the man that was blind, and they said to him, give God the praise. We know that this man is a sinner. And he answered and he said to them, whether he be a sinner or not, I don't know. But one thing I know, that whereas I was blind, now I see. And he's coming, brethren. He's coming along to an understanding. You can see it progressing, but he's not quite there yet. And in verse 26, they said to him again, well, what did he do? And how did he open your eyes? And he answered them, I've already told you, and you didn't hear. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you want to be his disciples? Oh, that's horrible. Don't say that to them. Well, they reviled him, and they said, you are his disciple. We're of Moses. We know that God spoke to Moses, and as for this fellow, we don't know where he's from. We don't know where he's from. And the man answered and he said to them, why is this a marvelous thing that you don't know where he's from and yet he's opened my eyes? See, the Pharisees haven't progressed in any understanding. They haven't been moved at all. They were blind when they asked Jesus about the signs of the times, and they're blind here too. Nothing has changed. Verse 31, now we know that God hears not sinners, but if any man be a worshiper of God and does his will, him he will hear. Since the world began, was it not heard that any man opened the eyes of one that was born blind? Never happened before. If this man were of God, he could do nothing. So now he cuts loose on the Pharisees and he really lets them have it. You know, he gave them this stinging rebuke. This man who before he didn't know where Jesus was, now asserts that he knows where he came from. He comes from silence to ignorance to a claim of recognition to assertion of divine revelation. If this man were not of God, he could do nothing. And his development becomes complete in one sense when he sees Jesus again in verse 38 and he says, Lord, I believe. And he worshiped him. And so here we have over the course of 38 verses, this man who was blind from birth, who has progressed from blindness to seeing, to believing, to understanding. And not only is this the process that we take when we're being called by God, brethren, but we take this same progression even after conversion. I think there's a rudimentary understanding of the Bible, of biblical doctrines, of who and what God is, and of God's expectations for us in this life, and even more so in the life to come. But as we progress along this narrow path, we have this scripture in Proverbs that says this. It says, the path of the just is as the shining light that shines more and more unto the perfect day. And so as we progress along the path of righteousness, the light of the truth and the light of Christ will shine upon us even more as we reach that perfect day when we enter into the gate of perfection. I'd like you to turn to John chapter 1 and John chapter 1 for a final scripture. John chapter 1. I'm sorry, 1 John. Sorry, 1 John chapter 3. 1 John chapter 3. The neurologist Oliver Sacks had said one time, he said, we spend a lifetime learning to see. We spend a lifetime learning to see. And so it is with belief. Understanding what we believe is a lifetime's work. It's kind of like the highways of Missouri. It's always under construction. Always in progress. We're always seeking coherence, meaning, and understanding. 1 John chapter 3 and verse 2. John writes, Beloved, now are we the sons of God, and it does not yet appear what we shall be. You see, we don't have full understanding. 1 Corinthians 13 says, we see right now through this glass darkly. We can't, brethren, quite put all of the pieces of that cat together, even today. Sometimes we only see a bits and pieces of it, just parts of it. And you know, maybe there are some of us who can only see a paw or a tail or a nose, and others can see that whole cat. Others have that better connection center. But the time will come, Paul says, that when we see him face to face. John adds, but we know that when he shall appear, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. We will be able to put all of it together. We'll see Christ as he is in full truth and full glory and full righteousness. What a wonderful time it will be to have that full understanding. And with the healing of this blind man from birth on the last great day, Christ was pointing to the ultimate time when not just us, but all mankind will be healed of their blindness. And all mankind who were spiritually blind from birth will step into that pool, because the knowledge of the Lord will cover the earth. It will cover the earth as the waters now cover the sea. And all men will be immersed into that knowledge and will know God, even from the greatest to all the way to the least. And so the story of Sheryl and the blind man from Bethsaida give us an insight into our calling and our conversion process. To continue on our path to ultimate sight and understanding, we have to, with a softened and fleshly heart, believe that God has called us in the right time with his full wisdom, with his full knowledge and understanding, and that he will not leave us, and that he will complete his work in us till the end. What a wonderful blessing to know the plan of God, brethren. We've just wrapped up this Holy Day season. We've just completed it. And to know that ultimately God will not open only the eyes of all those who have been, well, open everyone's eyes, all those who have been spiritually blind from birth, but he will give them all this perfect understanding of the perfect life in Christ.